Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. If you'd like to find more sessions, interviews, and story podcasts, visit our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. This podcast features a program session from the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference.
I'm Dennis Cromwell, and I'm from Indiana University. My title is Associate Vice President for Enterprise Infrastructure. So I'm here today to talk about deploying an internal cloud. So now that we want to deploy the cloud, I imagine that the dialogue may go something like this to talk about this with the senior officials, which is, I got this great idea and we're going to get there and don't worry much about the middle. I just need thousands of dollars to do it. And, you know, sometimes we have management that likes to think that maybe they want a little bit more explicit definition of how we're going to achieve some of those great results than a miracle occurs. And so one of the things that I do want to say about this, that what we're talking about is providing certain services at scale, leveraging each other, leveraging commercial, doing things above campus or at least at the high campus level to deliver better services in a more efficient manner to our constituents. You know, dealing with the cloud hype is really just getting in the way of thinking about this more strategically. I really do think it is important for us to understand, and rather than nitpick if a service is really a cloud or isn't a cloud or what are those items, that we really talk about it at delivering the right services at scale from an institutional perspective. And so one of the questions that I have to answer, why are we doing this institutionally so that next year and 2 years from now we can do it multi-institutionally? Because that's where we got to get. Because if we really have concerns about the privacy and security in the commercial cloud, then we need to be doing things here, but we need to be generating the scale to leverage these, because at some point in time, you know, the CFO is going to come in and say, this is too much money being spent on commodity services. So I think that's a real important aspect. I want to talk a bit about a cloud. I've been around the IT organization long enough to remember the whole wave of client-server computing. Right, kind of the mainframe. And the Gartner Group had a chart out that defined client-server computing, and it was in every presentation everywhere. But I think this is a really good example of talking, and primarily it's talking about buying cloud services. And it defines it into four levels. Now, I prefer to combine the bottom two levels and just talk about infrastructure as a service. But it really does say that you've got the hardware infrastructure and software infrastructure as a service, which is really the core line. Servers, storage, networking, the kinds of things that you would do in a data center, you will. I mean, and then you have the scenario of platform as a service, and those are delivered of certain higher level kinds of services in this stack. Things like web servers and file serving and print serving and application functions. In the commercial cloud, that would be things like Microsoft's Azure or Google's Apps Engine. Things for you to be able to, so that you're not having to worry about provisioning the web services and provisioning the databases and all those kinds of things. You can start using them. And then at the top level, there's software as a service, and clearly we understand that, and that might be email or eDoc services or, you know, the Salesforce reference, whether Salesforce.com. And I know a lot of people that were in the business of being an application service provider, being the old hosting services, are trying to reposition themselves as a software as a service function in the cloud. And again, I'm not going to get into nitpicky items of what is and what isn't. But I think really when we're talking about internal functions, we're probably talking about the bottom two and maybe even the third one up, because I do see a value. We've done a lot of provisioning of bare servers that we'll talk about in a minute. And we run something like 1,300 real VM servers. That's not counting the application appliances. And about 400 of those are provisioned outside of the kind of the common IT organization. It's being used by departments around the university or maybe another campus. One of the things I've asked our folks is, how many file servers do we really need to have in those 400 VMs? How many web servers do we really need to have? Let's get up to the point to where we're getting to this cloud service at the next level. And I think that's our next push at IU is getting that up to that next level so that we're provisioning space on a file server, not just provisioning a VM so somebody can run a file server. And I think that's a real, real key. So I think we've been, a lot of us have been in the business, and I know a number of you out here that have done work on smaller campuses than IU, and we're a pretty good sized campus, and in fact, I support primarily have direct IT support for two campuses, Bloomington and Indianapolis, and really I provide services for all eight campuses, all 100,000 students. So we are already trying to delve that that level of function. So so I know you're on smaller campuses. You're already at the point of trying to figure out how do I. I've already got the point. I only have a couple of file servers. I only have a couple of web servers, and that's great. I think one of the things we in the larger campuses can learn from is how to do that better from you folks. So I think that's the point. So, but primarily, we'll talk a little bit about infrastructure as a service, and I'm not going to get much into the technical details. If there's some questions, certainly I can take those. And if you've got some interest, I will talk a little bit about foundation functions here. I do want to talk a little bit about what makes up a cloud. And, you know, the CEO of VMware, now, a little bit self-serving, right? It says that virtualization is the foundation for cloud services. Now, again, that's maybe a bit self-serving, but I think probably very true. I mean, we didn't really talk about the cloud until we had major moves into virtualization services. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the virtualized data center, kind of what that means and where we're going and the kinds of technology that I think we needed to have in place to begin to offer the function of an internal cloud, the function of infrastructure as a service. And we'll mention a little bit about virtual VM software and networks and storage in this discussion. I would also say that the other aspect of cloud that to make something cloudy, if you will, is abstraction. And abstraction is a real key. So you can manage and run an operating system that's abstracted from the physical server. So it's no longer part of that. That one can manage and run a web server or an app server without worrying as much about where the operating system is and it can move and all. And you think you can abstract those kinds of things. Same kind of things as software as a service. If you look at Salesforce.com and their button that was showed this morning that really is no software, which is really defining that as software as a service and which is kind of really abstracting the whole aspect of software. So for virtualization and abstraction, I'll talk a little bit about virtualization here. Clearly the foundation for any virtualization runs to your VM software, your virtual machine software, so that it's the hypervisor and the sets of technology that go around the hypervisor to deliver a virtual server. Everyone in the room probably well aware of VMware, market leader in this, have been doing it for a number of years. That is our primary virtual server provider right now, is VMware. Certainly, they're there, all of the consultants rank them pretty high, but they're clearly not the only people in this game. And they're going to be caught, I think, very quickly in some areas because there's a couple of big players after them. And one of them is of course, Microsoft with Hyper-V. And their virtualization strategies. I know many of us in the business are always a little skeptical about going to Microsoft to buy a product to run other operating systems on top of. And I think that's something we'll take a look at. But clearly, in the Microsoft stack, Hyper-V has got a lot of capability and they've got market force. And then there's the various things that are based on the Xen, which is really the open source virtual hypervisor. Certainly the Citrix model, which deals a lot with desktop stuff and application virtualization. And now Oracle in the virtualization game. And if we think that Microsoft will be a player, Oracle is going to be a player there too. I mean, they certainly don't go after a market to be second. And so that's a true item. So and they've got some pretty impressive things on the Oracle VM. So those are the kind of the commercial players. We're really all in VMware. I think you can, you know, it really. Sometimes I get myself into trouble with this point of view, but I often don't think it's the technology that differentiates the selves. You can make any technology work. You got to deal with the people and the politics and the culture and the making it happen. And you can make the technology. And like I said, sometimes I've got myself into trouble because I've discounted the fact that there are some advantages good technology provides. And VMware provides good technology. And so I think that's a good aspect in here. Virtual storage. Little bit harder to define, I think, what virtual storage is all about. But it really, clearly we understood that back in when you had direct attack storage and you had your operating system that kind of directly controlled the disk, or at least the file systems on top of those. And then we moved to a storage array component, whether that's a network attached or SAN environment where more activities are, you know, LUN management and RAID and those things are pushed to the array functionality. And in the virtualization aspect, it's really adding software back into the aspect that runs on, and you know, we can argue, is it running on the array, is it running on the fabric, but more and more now it really is in the array functionality. And what is the virtualization software doing in a storage situation? Well, it's providing really high level services like replication or snapshotting. Oh, okay, you guys know what I mean. It was easy for you to say. And then also really interesting things like dynamic provisioning and thin provisioning. And those technologies become really important as you start to develop a cloud service. And dynamic means that I can grow and grow very rapidly grow amounts of storage that's given to any particular volume. Now, yeah, I know operating systems sometimes have problems dealing with those, but that's, you know, we work through those. Thin provisioning is the other real interesting idea, which means I'm giving the storage away to 100 providers, and maybe I'm giving a terabyte of storage away, but I don't have 100 terabytes. I only got about 60 terabytes on the back end. I've thin provisioned that. Everybody out there thinks they've got more than they have. Now, we've done this for years in the mail systems, right? You know, you give certain mail quotas, if you will. I hate the quota word, too. But you give certain mail quotas. And if everybody used that quota, you wouldn't have enough storage to provide it. Google does that. There's no way Google or Microsoft have enough storage to provide the amount of quota that they give everybody. They just realize that most people are only using 10% of it, and that's how they deal with. So that's what thin provisioning is all about. It means you got to manage a little bit better, but you really can see how that's a very effective process. And we implemented thin provisioning. We run right at the borderline of the recommendation from the SAN, and we're right now have something like 75% of our real storage out there that we've provisioned, and so it has been a real effective cost saving measure. So that's storage virtualization. I think it's a big part of this. You have network virtualization. I got two slides that kind of depict this. We did a implementation of a VM, and I'll go through our history, but it's been a while back, and it had a very traditional zone model for a data center, which means that we had a rack of network switches, and we ran cables to that rack of network switches from the VM environment. And when you run 7 cables per physical server and, you know, to a rack, and you're putting, you know, 4, 6 physical servers in a rack, you all of a sudden get a row that looks a little bit like this. And let me tell you, if you can imagine trying to plug all that stuff in your switches in a rack, it was a real spaghetti function. So clearly, you have to, as you get into this at scale, we have to rethink how we deliver network services and the function. So we were blessed at Indiana University. I just went through and oversee the movement into a new data center So we're in a brand new data center from an old data center in Bloomington, and we were able to redefine the network. Although this is the logical drawing, you don't see the wires. Basically, what happens, we put a network switch on the top of every cabinet, of every rack. It provides 10 gig connectivity to any of the physical servers in that rack, 3 per physical server, so we've cut down the amount of items. It only goes up to the rack, and then the rack goes back in multiple, or the switch connects in multiple ways back through the core router in the data center, through the firewall, and then out to the campus. We estimate that we had originally had a data center estimate of what it was going to take to network our environment as we moved into the data center. In the old way, we redesigned it in this way, and we saved about $500,000 in cabling with this scenario, to give you a perspective of what that kind of function is. Now, clearly, how many people here know what the Cisco Nexus switch is? So we've got a spattering of functions. Kind of the first wave in the area of delivering both a storage network and a data network across the same fabric. Now, we still have a storage network that's separate from the data network, but it's pretty clear when you're in this business that the bandwidth for Ethernet is going to far outstrip the bandwidth for fiber channel. So this whole virtual merging of the networks, and so the whole idea of a virtual network, I think, is going to take on another big meaning, because we'll be plugging in an Ethernet network, and that'll be delivering both the storage and your traditional data components to your servers. And so, and the kinds of management tools that will need is another direction. So that's what I think about what's important to put in place. And if you haven't done this and you're starting to move into virtualization and you're starting to offer it as a cloud service, thinking about that is a daunting experience. And a lot of the questions that we get are, how are you able to do this? How are you able to pull it off and put it together? And I have to start answering that question by going back to 1998. Now, that's long before there was virtualization. Right. Long before there was, I guess one can argue that if you lived in some of the IBM mainframe world, you've been in virtualization since then. But, you know, I won't get there. And that really was what happened is the Indiana University developed a strategic plan. And that's the cover of the document that we put it out. And it kind of laid a groundwork, and it laid a groundwork for virtualization. And one of the really key aspects of this, and I go back to this in completely, is that that strategic plan had a whole lot of projects that it laid out. Things like implementing a new student information system and a new, you know, the whole ERP suite. You know, doing something in course management, a new library information system, a whole set of those kinds of things. And we made a fundamental decision not to put the budgets for infrastructure in the individual projects. We pulled them out of the projects, and actually this was an argument that I got and won, which was good. We pulled them out of the projects and put them into a single infrastructure budget. So although we were getting money for we understood that to implement PeopleSoft, we're going to need some more server resources, and we had that money allocated in that strategic plan, but it came into an infrastructure budget instead of a PeopleSoft budget. And I think that was a really, really, you know, it's a simple little thing, but it was an intelligent decision. And if you get those kinds of discussions at your institutions, think about that. Because what it does is it gives a tremendous amount of flexibility from the delivery of an infrastructure point of view. We are able to create fungible resources. That was a term we used, actually, in the first strat plan. And I even heard it used the other day when I was in the Oracle session, and Oracle's chief architect was talking about why virtualization was so important. He used the word fungible, and I thought, he's read our strat plan. No. Okay, thanks. It also, what we did was then, it was really incumbent on those of us that manage infrastructures to manage the capacity at need. But, you know, most of us who were managing those infrastructures at the time were kind of used to that. It was called a mainframe. And although our technologies that we had in 98 to deliver that was a little bit different and sometimes a little bit tougher, we were able to do that, and we proved it pretty regularly as we had bought a server for one project to deliver, and because we basically decided on a set of architectures, some of the project timelines shifted, so we actually implemented the library system before a student system, although the technology was bought for the student system first, if that makes any sense. Because we were able to standardize on this, and we made some technology decisions for the greater good. Because, you know, I mean, you guys have all been in the business of figuring out what kind of servers and storage and stuff to deliver for what kind of products. And, you know, if you looked at PeopleSoft or SAP or SCT Banner, you know, there's certain technologies that might fit really well there. But if you looked at Blackboard or Sakai or something like that, it's a set of technologies that works pretty well for there. But there's things you can put together that works good for all of the common good. And we're able to do that, and that was real effective. How do you get the all of the individual projects for thinking that infrastructure is free? It's difficult, but in some ways I don't mind that. I mean, you know, obviously it's a balance between the two, because if they ask for really wild stuff, if they're trying to do new stuff, if they're trying to move in, you clearly have to add some additional capacity to deal with that. But on the flip side, I really like the idea that the application folks are focusing on solving the application and not worrying about what kind of servers that they've got to run their application on or how many CPUs have to be in their servers and those kinds of things. So it's a trade-off. So in some ways, I kind of like the idea that they think it's just there and readily available. And then, you know, you just do it with dialogue on the flip side, and we're able to do it. But that's a really good question. It is difficult, but I think it has its advantages as well as its disadvantages. The other thing we're able to do is we're able to invest in technologies then that no single project could have actually done. So I think this was a good piece. And so our investment in the cloud, if you will, began, though no one knew it was a cloud. We actually deployed our first virtual machine in 2003, and it was for we had had this wild project that somebody who wasn't quite a CIO then thought was a good idea called the Sakai Project. And we had to implement the first version of Sakai as our course management system. It was a pretty early virtual machine, Java implementation. If you knew anything about Java back in 2003, giving it more memory didn't work really well. You were better off having more servers and balancing load and those kinds of things. Well, we were faced with either having racks of pizza boxes or thinking about this new VM stuff that was there. And 2003 is when ESX was introduced, and we thought it was item. So we were going to conferences in 2005, and people were saying, well, you know, you're deploying your test and development systems there and, you know, experimenting with this. And I got to turn around and say, no, we put mission-critical Tier 1 application in our VMware first in production. And it's not, you know, we're not the riskiest people in the world, let me tell you. Higher ed's not a risk, a risky item. But we felt compelled enough that was the only way in a particular fashion that we could support that application, because we knew that the growth of use of that was just going to scale tremendously, and we needed that kind of flexibility. And so we did it. And, you know, sometimes you do things that work really, really well, and sometimes you don't. Well, in this case, it worked really, really well. And so we're able to deal with all of those functions. And as we moved through those first sets of implementation, we got about a 40-to-1 gain in terms of 40 physical servers on a single, or 40 physical servers or 40 logical servers on a physical server. And so a tremendous benefit. After we got through that first gain and we implemented some of the new systems in that, the other side of that was, oh, geez, should we think about doing some other things with that? And we went through, if you will, kind of waves, starting with the kind of the core enterprise information system stuff. So anytime we had a file server, a web server, an application server, and it was supporting one of those major applications that we all support, ERP, and we do library, and we also support course management and all those other kinds of things. We put that in VMware, under Linux, by the way. That's our primary delivery. Then any of the other servers we had. Then we went around because, you know, we're an IT organization and lots of people run servers, right? You know, the help desk run a server and some of the other places run servers. And we went out and we brought those servers in, at least a really good portion of them. And so we kind of took care of our own, eating our own dog food. And it was about then, actually a year behind when my boss wanted it to be delivered, we started delivering this as a service to the campus community that says, now you and the geology department, if you want a server, come and take advantage of our virtual server environment. Now, we did price that, and we do price it for them. It cost money, and so I'll talk about that in a minute. And so it was really, really exciting as we deal with this. One of the things that's on this bullet that you might scratch your head with is it says it removes the traditional conflict of interest. You know, I've been in the business of doing enterprise services for a long time. There's many of situations where departments have come to us and said, will you run a server for us? It sounds great, but then the beginning of the semester comes up and we're having problems with student registration and their file server dies. Who gets the priority? Well, guess what? The student administration. One of the things that we're able to do in this environment, it's the same. We run the same infrastructure that supports our course management system, that supports our student information system, that supports that file server. So I'm able to organize this in such a way that we deliver the same level of service across everyone. It's really been effective in that delivery of functionality. So we kind of moved in this direction. That's some things to think about in there. And the intelligent infrastructure is how we branded our internal cloud offering. And I would encourage anybody can go out and take a look at the web. We describe what we offer out there. We offer basic virtual services. We also offer some storage services. We offer some backup services. It's priced out there that you can take a look at for the department. It is a self-provisioning system. You go into a website, you fill out the form, you hit the submit button. Not automatically provisioned, but it goes into our work queue and the administrators provision it for you. So it's typically cloud-like. Thanks for attending. Enjoy EDUCAUSE. It's been a great start so far. Really good day. Thank you.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts, or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.